This is a great opportunity for us to talk about how both scientific research and news reporting can teach us different things and help us answer some different questions. And I think that's where we'll start tonight.
I would second Tammy. Thank you all for coming. I finished my master's degree this summer, and so I know how busy students are with work, and I know how busy everyone is with personal lives. So thank you for being here. I think this is a really great opportunity, and I'm very, very excited to see University of Delaware having this conversation. I think it's one that is needed on college campuses, but just also in our communities in general. And the same for you. It's very funny. I was going back through coverage and realized I interviewed you like 2 years ago. So the world is small. But I think in this conversation too, so is Delaware, which is all the more reason to have this conversation. Just to get everyone started, we have both kind of decided we would love questions as we go. If there are topics, if there are things that pop up, if you have questions, please ask. But I always think it's helpful to kind of start off the room with like what I call the great equalizer. And so if you're comfortable sharing, if you're comfortable raising your hand, I'm not asking anyone to get up and do jumping jacks. But how many of you have been prescribed an opioid painkiller for a procedure that you've had? Cool, my hand is up as well. How many of you took that opioid painkiller? Cool. And how many of you probably still have it in your home today? Okay. So my hand is up for all three, by the way. I always ask that because I think it's really important when we talk about the opioid epidemic, and I'm warning in advance, I tend to say opioid and heroin epidemic because one cannot be talked about without the other. But I think it's important because 80% of people who go on to use heroin will tell you that they started with a prescription opioid medication. And so I always think when talking about addiction, and it's something that for me hits home in coverage, is that we have to talk about perception and stigma. And so I always like to put it out in the room just to try and clear the air immediately that a large majority of us have been exposed to the medication that has led us to where we are today. Mm-hmm. So I always think that's important.
So it used to be, and prior to the opioid problem we are currently dealing with, people got their pathway to addiction to any drug started with alcohol and then marijuana. And there's a lot of coverage on sort of what we would call the pathway to addiction. And that's what I think she's referring to, is that prescription painkillers have become the new origin drug that leads others down, leads to that addiction pathway, and that drug comes from the legitimate medical community, comes from, and we're going to talk tonight about how that is different from other drug problems we've had and faced as a culture, and how it's also a reminder of something that also that happened at the turn of the 20th century and in the late 1900s. So let me clarify that the tolerance builds to drugs, and the tolerance that one builds from taking prescription opioids like Oxycontin and Percocet and things like that, if you don't take them, produce withdrawal. And then you take others, and as your tolerance builds, you have to take more of the same substance, or you have to take stronger potency opioids to ward off the withdrawal symptoms and to achieve the effects that those initial drugs did. That eventually, the building of tolerance and the prevention, the desire to prevent withdrawal symptoms, is what leads people down the path from relatively benign opioids that are prescribed to them to more dangerous, severe ones down the road. But I have a question for the audience before we get to how do we know what we know about a death a day in Delaware. What do you all know about the opioid problem here in Delaware, and where'd you get your information? Nothing? How many know something and they heard it from a friend or a family member, like a personal story, right? Absolutely. Of course. That's one common way we learn things from each other. And what we find is a lot of people have, as you said, have been impacted by the opioid epidemic. It's something that we're hearing a lot of. Another way is we read news reports that people like Brittany. How many people read the newspaper and have read something about the opioid problem in Delaware in the newspaper or some other media source, whether it's a government official speaking on television or, right. I'm going to ask a question, and I think we'll probably get the fewest number of hands. How many of you have learned something about the opioid problem from scientific research in peer-reviewed journals? Right. that's where our work tends to show up. And so what's really interesting for us to do is to talk about the different kinds of information that we get and to discuss the extent to which they complement each other. And the other way is are there instances where they contradict each other? So, you know, I have a history of doing research on several drug problems throughout the course of time. And what I'd like you to do is to think about, as I mention them, I'd like you to think about the traits and the characteristics of the people who are involved. And I want you to hold on to that, okay? So the first drug problem I studied as a young graduate student was the crack cocaine and powder cocaine problem of the 1980s. I was in graduate school. And I want you to think about the characteristics of crack cocaine addicts that perhaps were what do you know about crack cocaine addicts at the time? And then after that, I did study heroin injectors who were at risk for HIV infection on the west side of Chicago in the 1990s. And if you know anything about the west side of Chicago, it's a depressed socioeconomic area. And but those were heroin injectors back in the early 1990s, before the first wave of this epidemic took hold. From there, I studied a population that was receiving benefits, disability benefits, for drug abuse. And that was part of the welfare reform project of when Newt Gingrich, you know, was in control of Congress and we had the Welfare Reform Act. Those benefits were terminated. And you no longer can get disability benefits from our federal government for drug addiction and alcoholism. From there, I went on. I came to UD and I studied ravers, clubbers who were using club drugs. And think about the image of a raver and a clubber who was dancing all night to fast music. And then I'm now studying the drug problem. And I want you to think, what strikes you about how the faith of drug users has changed over time? Because I'm sort of struck by that as well. And how we talk about the people. Think about how we talk about it.
Well, and so Tammy and I had gone back and forth a little bit before this event, and I think she brings up a great point in talking about all that, and so I don't want to steal her thunder. But thinking about those people, I think it's really important to also consider, as a member of the media, how that's been portrayed as well then on our end. And we talk about it a lot, I think, now. And I think we're hearing a lot more conversation about it. But when we think back to while the cocaine epidemic was large, it was seen as a problem, right? So we talked about it as criminalization. We talked about the people using it. And we talked about a very large narrative that we kept hearing about how this was a bad drug, it was a dirty drug, and it needed to be criminalized. That has totally shifted now. And we're starting to see law enforcement talking about the war. I mean, one of the most quoted things I think I hear from police in Delaware right now is we lost the war on drugs. It didn't work. We now have a lot of people that are either incarcerated or getting out that serve time for a lot of minor drug offenses that really didn't do much good. And so now when we talk about the face, I think it's important because I will say it on the record. I think our media coverage, unfortunately, was very much slanted in a way that made people who use drugs out to be very bad people. And I think there's a much bigger conversation now about changing that. But I think we also have to talk about the fact the way our world looks at drugs now. In the last 10 to 20 years, we've actually started to identify addiction as a disease rather than a choice. We don't hear that as much anymore. We don't hear someone saying, well, you know, that's a bad choice that they made. No, we hear addiction being talked about as a disease. And we're actually seeing policy and leaders respond to it in that way. I think your point about faces is so important because in the back of your mind, and I will come back to this too, one of the joys that I have of doing my job is I get to tell a lot of those personal stories. But consider who, I mean, be stereotypical for a minute. Consider the face that you have in your mind right now when thinking about all of this.
Right.
And carry it with you through this conversation because I think it's an important part of what we're trying to get at.
I've had the privilege of using what we would call different techniques to study these different drug problems and the people impacted by them over the course of my career. And most of my time I spent as a street researcher. I went out and I talked and interviewed people. It's only recently where I've shifted into more statistical research and you know, documenting large trends. So I heard lots of stories. I mean, I gathered stories and worked in a clinic. That was our shop in Chicago. It was a clinic, a storefront on the west side. We brought heroin injectors in. We interviewed them. I heard the details of their life. I could see the impact of their drug use on them with their hands swollen from scars of injecting. And I think that they had many of the same problems that today's opioid misusers and addicts do too. But back then, we had a very criminalized viewpoint on them. Addiction was not yet a disease of the brain. And while I sometimes have to shake my head and go, oh, and not to be sort of regretful, that people from yesteryear who were suffering from addiction in many of the same ways that people today are, did not get the benefit of the doubt. I hope we never turn this page. I hope we never turn this page back to a criminalization focus, because these are people suffering from health problems, okay? And stigmatizing them for their problem is not going to help us as a society, and it's not really going to help them. So we are exactly where Brittany says we are today, a more humanitarian focus, a focus on public health, a push to get resources where they are. In the state of Delaware, there's lots of resources and initiatives happening right now with fantastic people out of the Lieutenant Governor's office, out of Department of Health and Social Services, private companies working to provide health treatments. And I really hope we never turn that page back, but we still have work to do to destigmatize this as a disease.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting when we talk about, I've thought a lot about, I mean, Tammy is coming at this from a very science perspective, and it was interesting. I went back to school this past year, got my master's degree, and one of the big conversations we had is how do we merge a lot of the great research that's being done and a lot of the great stories that are all a part of that data that Tammy is working with that I'm not necessarily dealing with, but I'm doing more on a case-by-case basis. And so part of my role, my background here in Delaware, I've been here for about 3.5 years now. About half a year into my time here, my editor at the time tasked me with explaining what the opioid epidemic was in Delaware. I do not purport to be any expert. I was very, very lucky to be a part of the National Press Foundation training that they did on opioids and what exactly was going on. And I've had the very large pleasure and benefit of getting to work with a lot of families and people who have been impacted by this on a very real level. And their stories are heart-wrenching and hopeful and all kinds of emotions. But what I will tell you is it's really interesting to think about what is getting people to engage in this conversation. Because what I would say to all of you is, you all have a reason to care. That's why you're here, right?
Right.
You came tonight because this matters to you for whatever personal reason that may be. But my job as a journalist is to try and figure out how do I engage the larger population in talking about this, in understanding it, in wanting to have a conversation about what, frankly, is not a very uplifting topic most of the time. What I've learned is that personal stories matter. If I can tell you about a real person and a real name and a real face, it is going to sink in a lot more. What that can get from the science aspect of criticism is that I use one story as a case study, which by default, one person is not going to be the experience of everyone else. But I would say that I think in Delaware, as Tammy mentioned, there is a lot of work being done, and that can't be ignored. The state of the heroin epidemic and the opioid epidemic here is bad. I mean, we titled it a death a day for this presentation because that's what we're on pace to lose this year. That is what the numbers thus far for this year have shown. And interestingly enough, when we talk about faces, it's not just one face. So whatever vision you have in your head, I can promise you I've talked to someone that doesn't fit it. That has a totally different story, that might break the anomaly, that might break the pattern that we see. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with those patterns. But all I ask is that as a journalist, but also as a human being who has gone out and interviewed a lot of different people, don't let that face that you might have be the face that you expect or be the only face that you're willing to accept. Because we're going to share, I think, a lot of different things that we've seen over the years. But what I will tell you is there are a ton of people affected by this in Delaware. And a lot of their stories look the same, but a lot of their stories look very different. And I think it's really important whenever we talk about this to honor those individual stories and to recognize that your experience might not be someone else's, and that does not make it any less valuable.
So how is, one of the things that we talked about is discussing how the current opioid epidemic is different from ones we've had previously. And I can think of a couple reasons. I'm sure that you all, and please feel free to comment and ask questions. One is death, okay? That this is what death and the death rate is something that makes the current opioid epidemic so different. We have not seen this amount of deaths from a prior drug epidemic in the course of history. I think the only thing that might have come close, some research suggests, was the gun violence that characterized the crack cocaine epidemic. But I do think that overdose deaths will probably surpass that. As you know, it is overdose deaths are the number one non-accidental?
Leading cause of death.
Surpassed traffic fatalities. If you take a look at the numbers in Delaware, and we're going to show you a map here, but in 2013, think of what you were doing in 2013, the state of Delaware had about 189 overdose deaths. By 2017, there were closer to 350. So over a period of time in this small state, they more than doubled and were on pace, as Brittany said, to surpass that number this year. So death is one of the differences about this epidemic, and that's what makes one of the things that makes this epidemic so tragic. And that is rightful that we pay attention to that, but there's some other important markers of this opioid epidemic that we can't take our eye off of. Lost workplace productivity. We have dangerous numbers out of the Council of Economic Advisors that show people are dropping out of work at rates we haven't seen before because of opioid misuse disorder. We have babies being born to suffering from neonatal abstinence syndrome, okay? That's another complication. The opioid epidemic is guesstimated to cost us more than $1 trillion per year, and people say that is a conservative estimate. So while we're all, of course, focused on death as the ultimate consequence, there are other markers of this opioid epidemic consequences we've traditionally paid attention to that aren't getting as much discussion.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. In the fall, this past fall, the News Journal actually sponsored a What Heroin Costs Delaware. And we tried to actually, for the first time, really break down the cost of this heroin and opioid epidemic on the state. The kicker that I hate to tell all of you, no one really knows. And yep. I hate to say this, but the state is not actively tracking it. And they were pretty blunt about it because we reached out to law enforcement. We reached out to EMS. And people could give you bits and pieces. They could tell you how much naloxone costs. They could tell you what an ambulance ride may cost. But on this larger value, and something that the council, actually, financial advisors, they put out that report just before we published the story, so it was great timing for me. For the first time, people are actually trying to figure out what the loss of a life would cost. And I say that with an asterisk because, obviously, there is no way to put a cost on the life of a person. But what these council of financial advisors tried to do is determine what is the value they would have added to the world financially, in the workplace, in all of these different avenues that we don't think about. But Tammy's right. There are dozens of babies born exposed to drugs, specifically opioids and heroin. And unfortunately, a lot of the research is that we don't really know what those effects are going to be on children down the line. There's some preliminary stuff, but it's still pretty new. The other thing that I would add to it, and not just the hospital costs that we're talking about, but where do these moms with their children go? Sober living facilities are a big thing, and I'm sure if any of you have turned an ear to kind of the larger conversation, we talk about treatment availability here in Delaware and what's available to people who want to get help and need it. One of the biggest issues is for women and children. Where do those women go, and where do they go that they can take their children with them? Because I hate to tell you this, the foster system is wrecked right now by the opioid epidemic, largely because we're seeing grandparents turn into caregivers. We are seeing people that are in a much different phase of their life being asked to take care of very small children. And sometimes, I mean, in great scenarios, we're seeing the parents get help. In the worst scenarios, we're seeing them die. Yeah. It happens. It happens every single day. And I think that's a great point, though, that this cost idea, which as much as it's very frustrating, I will tell you, society gets. Because the minute you say taxpayer dollars are going somewhere you don't want it to go, everyone sits up. Right. So it is. It's an interesting part of this, but it's something, unfortunately, I don't think our country has a very good grasp on yet, just what this long-term cost loss is going to be.
Good.
Another thing I think is different about the current opioid epidemic than the ones that I've been researching, like the crack cocaine epidemic, the rave phenomena, and I didn't even mention the methamphetamine problem of the 80s and 90s, is this one began, as Brittany said, and this tacks into what the two men's questions were. This one began in doctor's offices. You know, it began with the legitimate pharmaceutical industry. And I had my class, I'm teaching a class right now on the opioid epidemic, and I had my class work with me to produce a timeline for the origins. And sir, this gets a little bit back to what you were asking about earlier. And so if you take a look at some of these factors that just converge like a perfect storm, right? So you had OxyContin come out on the market in 1996, and it was marketed as an addiction-proof drug. And, you know, Purdue Pharma went across the country, they talked to doctors, they invited them to resorts for educational seminars, and they used a few, I think two studies, that one was a paragraph long in the New England Journal of Medicine, and the Porter and Jick paper, and they used that to justify saying that addiction is a result in a very, very small number of cases. And about at the same time that Purdue Pharma was, you know, debuting this product that they convinced the medical community would have little risk of addiction, pain got deemed the fifth vital sign. Right? And you and I have a right to be relieved from pain from our medical doctors. And doctors have an obligation to treat our pain. Rise of the pain clinics, right? Rise of treating pain at the same time. Well, you know anything about drug, just those two factors, and we come together with a timeline of more, put so many opioids in the hands of people were going home. At the beginning, there were pill mills too, and the pill mills were allowed to dispense drugs. It's not as though you got your prescription from a doctor and had to go to a pharmacy. At pill mills, you could pick them up. And the basic prescription, if you read Dreamland, if you read American Pain, which are great books, by the way, people were getting, as a prescription, 350 Oxy-40s and 180 benzodiazepines, okay, at their first appointment. Nobody takes that many pills. They were assuming they would take about 8 of them a day. What ended up happening is those pills were sold and diverted. People earned money by selling them. They came from Kentucky to Florida. They went from West Virginia to Florida, and they picked them up there. Or they used them, and sir, they developed tolerance to them. They developed tolerance to taking, having that big surplus of pills, and they then transitioned to higher, more potent doses, leading them. That's why we have the opioid epidemics in three waves. We're in wave three now. We're in the first wave was prescription opioid death. The second wave was both heroin and fentanyl. We're now in the third wave, which started at about 2013 and is raging on right now. And most of the deaths are dominated by fentanyl, which is a much more potent opioid that is extremely dangerous. Is there a question? Oh, so you can do the mic thing. So that's another. But the gentleman in the white shirt who asked the question earlier, you know, when Brittany first started tonight, she had you raise your hand if you had an opioid prescription. And a lot of you put your hand up. But I bet very few of you have an opioid problem. Right? So is that the other way to look at what you're talking about? Yeah. So I had this conversation with a guy I was on a flight with, and you know, I was busy going over a paper, right, that I was working on. I know, don't sit beside me when I when I fly. I was working on a paper, and he said, I'm sorry, but I'm looking over your head, and I see that you're writing about the opioid problem, and you know, I'm interested in this topic. And I talked to him. He had, you know, a knee replacement, and he had a back problem, and he was prescribed lots of painkillers, and he just couldn't wrap his head around why some people develop addiction to them and others don't. And there are some questions that we haven't answered yet. We have to answer. What distinguishes somebody like the people in this audience today who can take opioid painkillers, right, and who have a right to be relieved from their suffering? They don't want to take Advil, you know, or, you know, an SAID, Tylenol or something like that for their pain. Why do we want to penalize all of them because of the risk of addiction? How do we balance that? You know, and I'm a researcher. The best I do is pass my findings on to people like, state practitioner policymakers, all right? And the policymakers pay attention to what Brittany writes as well. But they have the ominous job of solving the problem. Yeah. And they have the ominous job of deciding what laws to pass. And if they pass a law, Delaware legislator, constraining prescriptions for acute conditions to 7 days, there is going to be people who don't get the medication they think they need and feel like they're being penalized unfairly. It's a solving the problem, yeah, is difficult. Characterizing the problem and we're like the beginning of the problem solving, right? But actually implementing the solutions, allocating the resources for it, becomes really challenging.
Well, and it's also very worth pointing out. A lot of people talk about, well, why make the transition? And a lot of people will say, you know, why heroin? I mean, who really wants to use a needle and shoot something into your arm? I can raise my right hand to God and tell you right now, I have not interviewed one single person who ever looked at me and said, yeah, I woke up one day and I wanted to become addicted to drugs. There is something about brain chemistry. There is something about, I mean, I'm sure many of you in this room, if you are here tonight, have heard that there are talks about genes that leave you you all know what I'm trying to say, to addiction. It's been a long day. That there are different factors, that your brain chemistry changes. I mean, there are lots and lots of different theories, and there's lots of things that are still being researched by wonderful people like Tammy, and that is so, so important. But we all want answers now, right? I would love to wake up tomorrow and say, I don't need to write one more story about addiction other than the fact that we figured it out and we solved it. I would love to not sit down with another family member and have to walk through the struggle that they have been through. I would kill to do that. But it's important to think about this. A pill on the street is about $20 to $25. For a nice Vicodin, the Percocet, you name it, heroin's $5 a bag. Uh-huh. That is like cheaper than a good beer at a bar. Really? I mean, to think about that in perspective. I know we're near UD, so maybe beer prices are cheap around here. But, really, I mean...
drink at UD.
Oh, that's right. Never mind. Didn't you guys just get made one number one party school?
Yes,
yeah,
we did. We certainly did.
I mean, hey, I did go to Penn State, so I took a little issue with it. But, no, I mean, I do think it's important to think about on a personal level. I mean, I have a younger brother who had knee surgery. This was 8 years ago. They sent him home with 100 Percocet. I think, and I really mean this, I mean, I think as journalists it's important to acknowledge too, it is personal. It's personal for everyone. For anyone that says it's not, I would question their line of reasoning here. I think every day, I am so happy my younger brother did not have that reaction, did not have that feeling where, wow, I love how this feels. I've had oral surgery. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have had opioids prescribed for anything related to, like, dentist work?
Right.
I mean, I had it 3 years ago, and I told the doctor as I was coming out of anesthesia, he's like, I'm going to give you more Vicodin. I said, no, I don't want any. You're contributing to the opioid epidemic. I don't want any. I proceeded to have a very serious conversation with him once I was, like, cognizant with it. But I think it's important to consider that, like, this is not a moral failing of people for having this reaction to it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, really, I cannot stress enough, I've never talked to someone who has wanted to be in that position. About 2 years ago, we did a series on medication-assisted treatment. So this idea of giving people medication to help them either stave off cravings, to deal with withdrawal, and to manage their addiction, to kind of keep them at a baseline. And I was down at Connections in Millsboro, and I was sitting in a room, and one of the public information people, we got permission to talk to a couple people, and he said, oh, I'm going to bring someone back. And this woman walked in. And I kid you not, she sat down in front of me, and I'm like, do you have the wrong room? She was maybe this tall, had on a floral dress, sneakers like my grandma wears, probably my grandma's age. And I looked at her and I said, are you in the right place? And she said, yeah. I am in recovery for addiction to opioid painkillers. And I will never forget her name. Donna and I had a great conversation. Her doctor, she needed knee replacements, and her doctor said, you're kind of young for it. Let's hold off. Let's give you opioids instead. Let's treat your pain. We don't want to keep you in pain. She became addicted. She ended up losing her family. She lost her house. She spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on these pain pills. And she never touched heroin. She never touched heroin because she financially was able to never touch heroin. And she was very clear about that.
So that's
a real thing.
That tragic case is common.
Yeah.
Right? And it blends with one of the things I wanted to make sure to mention tonight, and that is, while it is true anybody can become addicted to opioid painkillers, there are some clear demographic patterns. And it helps us if we understand who is impacted and where. And we're going to show you a map here shortly, a sub-project that I'm working on that will be, as of tonight, it is public. We launched the project publicly. This is a public website, and I'm going to give shout-outs to my fellow CDHS colleagues for bringing this to light. But I'm worried about white men. I'm worried about white men this time. I mean, there's always a population, there's always a demographic that stands out. And this time, it is white males. There is something about males that will transition to illegal drugs at rates that women don't. And so what we saw at the beginning of this epidemic was the historical, perhaps, reversal of a trend in overdose deaths, that women were going to catch up to men. In previous opioid epidemics, drug epidemics, there was a big gap between males and females. And then the first wave happened, and women started to OD at higher rates. But now that the epidemic has shifted to heroin and fentanyl, that gap has reemerged. And women just do not transition to illegal drugs at the same rate that men do, and we now have a more familiar gender gap. And who is dropping out of the workforce? Males. Males are hit hardest by loss productivity. It's time for us to pay attention to some of these patterns. Yes, all of us can be impacted, but if there are certain groups that are more at risk, isn't it our job to address the special needs? There's not one size that'll fit all here. There really isn't.
Yeah. Now, I mean, to go back, think about the face that you have envisioned in your head. Anyone mind sharing what the image they have? I'm sorry, I'm jumping
in the back.
The mic.
Right,
sorry.
Eva. From the opioid epidemic. Right. And so by lumberjack, is that somebody situated in the country, in a rural setting?
Most of the time, yeah.
Most of the time in the rural. So how many of you think the opioid problem is the worst in rural areas? The country. Oh, only a few of you. Okay. Right. Well, let's take a look. Should we take a look
sure.
in Delaware?
Yeah.
Logan? Let's take a look. So this is, I'm going to move out of the way here. This is our project, the Delaware Opioid Metric Intelligence Project. It's funded by the National Institute of Justice. And this is an interactive mapping program that will give you information on markers of the opioid problem here in Delaware. And what you see there is currently the state of Delaware divvied up into about 214 neighborhoods. We call them, technically they're called census tracts. And the area, the map is shaded with hot spots. And the idea is that the redder it is, the higher the overdose rate is. So visually it provides a nice way to look at the distribution of overdose death hotspots in the state of Delaware. Now, if you click back to 2013, Logan, you can see there were far fewer hotspots, right? And then go to 2014, they begin to grow. Go to 2015, they shift a little bit. But they are. And then 16. And notice what's happening in the southern part of the state. Okay? See what's happening in the southern part of the state? And keep in mind, the neighborhood boundaries in the northern part of the state are smaller, so they visually may not look comparable, but they're based on population. Okay? And we all know population concentration is highest in New Castle County because of the city of Wilmington. And then go back to 2017. In Delaware, for this time period, the highest rates of overdose death are still concentrated in our urban areas, even though Seaford and Sussex County are suffering problems as well. And so you can what you'll be able to do with this is you'll be able to sort it by zip code. And so you can turn the map on, and now you can see it by zip code. You can also see it by house district, but you don't have to do that quite yet. But if you go back to the census tract map of 2017, the other thing we've done here is we've loaded where the methadone clinics and the residential treatment facilities are in the state, okay? And if you click on any one of the little neighborhoods there, Logan, can you give us an example? Okay, and you can certainly zoom in. If you click on any one of them, you get this little pop-up. And you get the name of the neighborhood, and then you can get the risk factors, the overdose death rate. And this neighborhood is very interesting because the tracked OD death rate is 81 per 100,000 population, but the opioid death rate is half that. What does that mean? People are dying, overdosing from drugs other than opioids. In some of the neighborhoods, they're one and the same. The opioid death rate and the total overdose death rate are exactly the same rate. So this is really good information because it suggests that, like other drug problems, okay, this, we hope, will peak and decline, but there's usually always another drug problem historically that comes behind it, and perhaps this can, something like this surveillance data can help us anticipate what's next and where it might be. So I encourage you to go to our web link, find your neighborhood, and take a look at the information over time. Yes, you have a question?
Hold on a second. Let's segue into the Q&A section.
Okay. Yeah,
so,
sure.
Again, reminder. So I'm going to hand you this mic so everyone can hear you, and I'm going to hold this mic so he can hear you. And look great. And Tom's passing out surveys for later use. Okay. Now.
Shoot. We've got a question right here.
Real quick. I'm unaware whether is fentanyl considered an opioid or is it considered a different category?
Yeah. I mean, I think the best way. In the past, people made a distinction between opiates and opioids. And I think today everybody is just using the phrase opioids as all of the drugs that hail from the painkiller and originate or emulate the poppy plant. And so fentanyl is considered an opioid, and people are even throwing heroin into the opioid category.
I came tonight hoping to hear some positive steps,
yes.
Some information about what might be done and how things might change. All this sounds very familiar to me. I've been hearing this kind of stuff for a long time and seeing it too. So any projects, any changes in laws or actual programs that are helping people?
Do you want to tell them about the new the piece on MATs that you just
wrote? Yeah, so there's lots of good news, and that is thank you for asking. That's a really it's a really really good reminder
because I
think
we were gonna get to that.
It is very easy to get caught up in the difficult things. There's a lot of great work being done. Recently, the state formed the Behavioral Health Consortium, and I will tell you, as someone who is a third party observer, there are new voices at the table, and there are unique voices at the table. And so work is actually being done. We're seeing the Behavioral Health Consortium has mapped out a 3-year plan with year 1, year 2, year 3. The great part about that is that they are actually looking at not just addiction, but mental health. So they're looking at the root causes of a lot of this stuff. So it's some of the work we've been doing, we've chronicled along. Dr. Sandy Gibney from St. Francis is doing some of that work, going out and legitimately just distributing naloxone on the streets, getting this harm reduction aspect going. They're talking about in coming weeks and months, coupling that with mental health outreach workers, with community health workers, to kind of make sure that they're having all-encompassing vehicle when they're out there. The state also recently launched Delaware START, which is going to look to create this continuum of care So that way, no matter where you are, if you fall off, if you relapse, or if you decide you need to get help, you're ready to get help, you can enter the system from a multiple different pathways. Right. And so I said, a lot of people describe recovery as a journey, and I said it's really unique. The state has taken on this idea of a pathway. They want people to find it. Right. Recently, there was legislation passed to create an overdose system of care. So that way, when someone overdoses, there will be a consistent response statewide, no matter where it happens to you. So it won't be that you got a really great doctor who understands addiction and knows how to respond. Instead, there's going to be consistent things put in place. We're seeing a couple hospitals open up stabilization centers there. So we're not looking to send someone to a Kirkwood detox. We're not looking to send someone else. We can actually keep people and make sure they're getting the help they need. There is a bunch of legislation stuff that's been passed and talked about. There's efforts to make sure that we have parity for people who are having issues with mental health and with addiction. And there's also been a lot larger effort to get insurance providers to support and approve things like massage therapy, like yoga, like physical therapy. Right. So alternatives to opioids. Because Tammy made a great point, and I hear it from readers all the time. There are a lot of people that legitimately need their opioid pain medication, and they want it, and they're in pain. And it's a story that we've been working on for quite some time, and it's a difficult one to tell, but it's important. So no, there's lots and lots of positive work. And I will tell you, there are so many, and it cannot be discounted, so many incredible people in recovery that are out there doing that work right now.
I live in Maryland. I don't know whether that's happening over there.
Oh, well, that's a good question. Yeah. But no,
great support groups. Attack Addiction is very active. When they first began, it's a support group for people suffering opioid use disorders as well as their families. And it started in Newcastle County, but now it's very active across the state. They even have members from Attack Addiction here who have been able to get laws passed in Delaware, like the Good Samaritan Law. That is, if you take somebody, drop somebody off at the hospital who's ODing, you can be free from prosecution. I hope I summarized that okay, David. He probably can help me out. Expanded access to Medicaid-assisted treatment, methadone, buprenorphine, and now Vivitrol. But we have to also, Vivitrol, methadone, and buprenorphine will help deal with cravings and withdrawal. But we also have to couple that with the social triggers, addressing the social triggers that could lead people back. It's one thing to handle the biological, neurological part, but, you know, if somebody's out of work, if they're depressed, if they're suffering from mental health, if they're around people who are using, those are social triggers. And the state is also working on a continuum of care. So it's all very, very encouraging. And we're doing stuff on the technology end. We're developing an app, for example, that will help people find the resources they need when they need them and near them. We're not quite ready to talk about that now, but there are other things like that which are happening. That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it.
Since you brought it up, a quick comment on the 911 Good Samaritan Law. It's been a law here in Delaware for 5 years. People should know about it. What it does is allow anybody to call 911 if they find somebody in medical distress. The idea is that they stay with that person in medical distress until the professionals arrive to revive that person. The other thing that even the people who are aware of the 911 Good Samaritan Law, it often gets lost, it also applies to underage drinking, which is hugely important, and there's not enough people that understand that.
It's, if I can add too, and not to put Dave and his wife on the spot back there, but I'm going to. It is really worth pointing out, not just locally but nationwide, that it is parents of who have lost children who are driving this effort. It is only recently that we are seeing, and recently as in the past few years, that we are seeing states and local officials really take on this charge. But that charge has been championed by parents who and loved ones who have taken their grief and put it towards something really, really meaningful. And so I always find it very important to remind that because it really, really is. And it is because of you guys that we are where we are today.
Hi, and quickly for the lady who had the question about positive measures being taken in Delaware, The Brandywine Counseling Center is now offering a syringe exchange within Wilmington, which is a great program. Syringe exchanges all around the country and in Canada have been shown to reduce HIV rates. They've been shown to get people into treatment faster because people handing out syringes usually give them the tools that they need to enter treatment and give them, you know, lots of information about how to make it affordable for them. Another really great thing is the Delaware Drug Court. Speaking of legislation, the drug courts help reduce penalties for people within their first and second offenses. As long as it's not trafficking or something huge, if it's minor, just like doing a drug, it, you know, prevents them from being incarcerated or having it on their record permanently. So those are two really good measures too.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. That's great.
Hi, so building off of, the last two things that have been brought up, I don't know if in the research you've seen, in Vancouver they actually opened a safe injection site. So I'm curious as to if we see something like that potentially happening. I know Philadelphia right now is currently advocating for one, but do you think having these kinds of facilities would create more positive outcomes for those that are going through things with opioids? Do you see that being something we could possibly do here?
So we wrote a story on this a little bit earlier this year. The answer from the state right now is that it is being talked about in very, very early stages. With that said, there is a lot of research into it. You will talk to people who are very, very strong advocates. From the harm reduction standpoint, it is a harm reduction measure. What I will tell you, however, though, is it is something that I consistently hear, though, from law enforcement and from legal people that say it is going to take a very, very long time, probably, for us to figure out how to implement it. I was speaking with a law enforcement officer up in Philly who said, for example, you know, if we were to pull someone over and they had a bunch of heroin in their car and they say, well, I'm going to the safe injection site to use, do they still get penalized? What does that look like if there's drug dealers outside of a safe injection site? And so it's definitely something that I think the state is going to talk about. And it's on the radar of state officials. It's on the radar of the Behavioral Health Consortium. But it's definitely something that locally here is in its very early stages and has been indicated to me that it will likely be seen how other places like Philadelphia handle it, because Philly's been talking about it for, I think we're almost to a year now, and it's a slow process, unfortunately, but it is a harm reduction measure and there's a lot of research out there, and so I think it depends too on the pathway you're looking at.
The increased availability of Narcan, the life-saving drug, is a big step in the right direction. So keeping what this map doesn't show you and what the news reports aren't, they don't cover, are the saves. The people who actually overdose and then get saved by their family members or get saved by other addicts, you know, that they're using drugs with because they have a couple doses of Narcan in their pocket. And those save the overdoses that aren't fatal. They're increasing as well. And I to tell you how dangerous this addiction is. The best advertisement a drug dealer could possibly have for his or her product is a bunch of people overdose on it. That is contrary to what you would think, but when people overdose on a drug, other addicts flock. Others flock to find that and purchase that product. Why do they do it? Because it must be very good. I've been hearing that story since the 1990s. People don't stay away from drug dealers who sell doses that people overdose from, they flock to them. That shows you what we're up against.
Question over here. It's you. Hi, I'm interested in the NAS babies born addicted. And because we have so many of them now, I wondered in your database, are you able to capture that number of the babies born addicted? And would they be counted as addicts? Would they be counted? How about that population?
So we don't keep track of them in DOMIP. DOMIP doesn't have them. But the CDC keeps track, I believe, of babies born addicted to. So the federal government has agencies. I don't know if our Department of Public Health does or not. I don't know if they do. My guess is that they probably do. And my colleague probably could answer that question better than I could. I know there's federal data on it, and there would be a rate for Delaware. We don't have it as part of our product, our project. They would be counted as addicted, but they're immediately weaned off before, my understanding, before they leave the hospital.
Yeah, we do have, there's been a council that's been formed to kind of manage this and deal with it. And I do find it's important to say, because I hear this a lot from healthcare providers and things, technically babies are not born addicted. They are just born substance dependent. And so it's a really good thing, because I just want to make sure I differentiate, because in this larger conversation of addiction, if addiction is a brain disease, a child is not born with that. They may be born substance dependent.
Detoxed.
Yeah, and there is question about what that could mean down the road, and that is those are all really, really good questions. But the state is tracking it. I believe recently, actually, it was a council that was formed to, in particular, study that data and look at it. And I have to say this, because I think what Tammy gets to do is so cool, but, like, please know that a lot of this data, because it's health data, is protected, and so it's data that myself, as a journalist, does not always have access to. So I think it's the coolest that you're doing this overdose map, because I've wanted this data
forever. Put that link in the News Journal tomorrow.
I would love to do that. We might be doing that tomorrow morning. but it is, I do think it's really important.
Shameful production.
I think it's really important to remind people
promotion.
That, too, though, when talking about this, because so much of the stories that we do and that I get to tell really are because people have the courage and bravery to come forward and share their story. Because I will tell you, health data really is protected in this state. And really, people, unless something happens very publicly, are pretty protected from me finding out exactly who they are and things like that.
So. Let me chime in on the NAS thing. Another thing to consider about neonatal abstinence syndrome or people born, babies born addicted. I think we need to learn lessons from some of the mistakes we made about crack babies. Science made a lot of mistakes. The medical community made a lot of mistakes, and there was a lot of bad consequences that came from that. Women got who gave birth to a crack addicted baby got sent to prison. Thank good we deemed crack addicted babies as a dysfunctional generation, and we later found out that within 2 years they had normal development, and in the meantime they bore the stigma of that era. I hope there's some lessons that we need to pay attention to the past. I know history is boring for a lot of people, but it's very important in not in problem solving, right?
A question for Ms. Horn. You've done a remarkable job covering the story. It sounds like you've been to every corner of the state, is that right? And talked to people whose families have gone through this and had those difficult conversations. And the passion you have about it comes through. So my question is, how does it feel when the President of the United States calls you and your colleagues enemies of the people?
My standard line is I am paid to not have an opinion. However, what I will say, and I think my editors will support me on this, I believe that it is issues like this where journalism is so important. Because I can tell you, I think about the conversations that I have had with families. I see familiar faces here in the crowd today, and it is impossible to look at any of them and not see their loved one and not see their one struggling. And it is a gift that I get to hear that story, but it is an even bigger one to be able to share that with people. And I think our world is a better place because of good journalism and because of us, you know, having a better understanding. So.
Thank you. Amen.
But thank you for your compliment.
Hi. I know that a lot of your research seems to be focused on the geographical point of view, but it also has a lot of individualistic information thrown in. Does your project also focus on data about opiate orphans?
No.
Okay.
Not this particular project. No, it doesn't. There may be an opportunity down the road, but that isn't something we've addressed. And we, by the way, we have a lot of research projects at the Center for Drug and Health Studies, and the director, Dr. Christy Vischer, is here in the audience with us today, and some of my other colleagues from CDAS. So we can act as a bit of a warehouse for information and point you in the right direction if you want to stop by our offices. But it's not a population that is currently part of my research projects.
Thank you. The receptors that, or the triggers that trigger this genetic signal for the receptors to hook onto those opioids, they've been there. I don't think that we have changed genetically so much in the few last, say, 50 years or so. What has changed is the availability of these opioids. Mm-hmm. So if there is the problem, if there is the issue, I didn't hear either of you talk about the producer of these drugs. I know there is some legislation that is in process about reducing the total product, but there are six major producer of these famous drugs, and if you look at their profile, the largest money-earning drugs are these opioids in their profile. So there is a place that effort can be put to reduce some of these problems.
So Delaware actually has a lawsuit against Big Pharma. I was actually in court arguments last week. Big Pharma had, I can tell you, 25 attorneys in a courtroom. I'm telling you, I was in a pink coat and I stuck out like a sore thumb compared to all the black and the gray and the blue. I will tell you, they are fighting to have the lawsuit dismissed in Delaware court. Matt Den, many of you know our state attorney general, has made very, very big strides in the opioid epidemic, took it on in a way that many attorney generals have not in the past, but are now in terms of legal matters. And they launched this, they launched a very, very big lawsuit against Big Pharma. They were able to keep it in Delaware court despite efforts to get it to federal court. But they are arguing for dismissal of the lawsuit. And we're talking on arguments of show us exact prescriptions that were illegally diverted. And mind you, these are companies that have already paid out millions of dollars in settlements with individuals, with organizations. Part of the reason we're seeing this pushback now is because we are seeing counties go after them, we're seeing cities go after them, we're seeing full states in efforts to recoup some of that money that has been lost. And so you are incredibly correct. There's also the argument that a lot of companies now making medication-assisted treatment, that the same companies who created the epidemic are now making the medications that are going to be used to treat the epidemic.
Create the problem.
That is a great question, a great argument, and I would encourage you to definitely stay up to date on it. We're going to keep covering it. It's really interesting. It's really important. But there is a judge out in Ohio that is handling a lot of the federal cases, and he basically has come out and said, like, consolidate them, figure out your settlements, and, like, let's deal with this because this is ridiculous. Like, this keeps happening. Let's go. Like, let's move it along.
The amount of money they have enables them to push back on a lot of the solutions that could be forthcoming. I mean, just their influence on the DEA and the their relaxing of the standards in when suspicious shipments from a distributor would come on the radar screen of DEA and therefore warrant an investigation. Retired DEA agents and you know, going to work for Big Pharma, or just the pressure that they put on the lobbying aspect, we have a formidable foe, in this problem. And, that whole industry side of it, definitely, we wait till the problem hits people, and then we offer solutions, But that's another way to solve the problem, is to tighten up, the manufacture and distribution of those drugs. We just have to be willing to do it.
So a bit on the opposite end of that, I enjoy thinking kind of radically and don't get the opportunity to discuss with an actual expert on something like this, and I haven't been able to find much research on something like this, maybe because it is ridiculous. But do you have any research or just your own opinions on legalizing drugs like these so that you know, they're put in a place where it can be more controlled and people aren't put in positions where they might take a drug that is, you know, potentially life-threatening or a dose that could otherwise be prevented if it wasn't illegal, or they might seek help if it wasn't illegal?
Which drugs are you talking about, if I may ask you to clarify?
Something like heroin. I mean, and I know that sounds crazy, but a prohibition, you know, when alcohol was illegal, there were more problems because of it. Mm-hmm. So do you have a gut reaction to that? I mean, I know it sounds crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, and I don't speak on behalf of my department or my center, all these disqualifiers, right, or my funders, I would not support legalization of heroin. I definitely would not do that. Not with what I have seen. And remember, legal drugs started this problem, right?
Yeah.
Legal drugs started this problem. I'm not sure that legalization, I hear where you're coming from. And I would say this to you. If we were waging a war on drugs and we were responding with criminalization with the full forces we did in the 80s, I think your argument carries more weight, but we're turning that page right now. And people who are suffering from opioid misuse disorder, we're not criminalizing them like we did in the past. And so with a more humane approach, a more public health approach, isn't that sort of what you're talking about anyway? Food for thought.
In response to the question about where the drugs are coming from, the pharmaceutical companies, none of them are going to release a nickel bag of heroin. The reason that heroin is so cheap is because every year since the fall of 2001, when we invaded Afghanistan, and just in time for the spring planting and the summer harvest, every year since then has been a record opium poppy crop. Donald Rumsfeld sits on the board of at least one pharmaceutical company. And the opium that makes the heroin comes from fields guarded by U.S. soldiers and supervised by the CIA. And they have a long history of bringing heroin into this country. You can Google Pan Am 103 and heroin, and you will see all sorts of sites come up from that.
Well, I'm going to agree and disagree with that. Here's where I'm going to disagree. I think I would have agreed with you for the prior heroin epidemics of the 60s and 70s, when most U.S. heroin did come from what we call that Golden Triangle, and I'm not saying there isn't a lot of heroin produced in the Golden Triangle, but today in the United States, most of the heroin comes from Mexico and Colombia. It doesn't come from Afghanistan. Mexico and Colombia. It's distributed in Europe and in Asia, and an addiction there is to Afghani heroin. Some of that is also goes into the manufacturing of semi-synthetic opioid painkillers that are distributed in the market. But in terms of the heroin, U.S. heroin today comes mostly from Mexico and Colombia. Mm-hmm. Right. And it is true that the sale of heroin helped supply Osama bin Laden. That is true, and that's well documented. But my point of departure from you is where most heroin in the United States come from today.
I know that a lot of your research focuses on the big opioid overdoses and whatnot. There have been a lot of things going around about a strain of opioids and a strain of heroin that's been going around certain music scenes, especially around here, that are not able to be helped through with the use of Narcan. Mm. Is there any kind of information that you have on that, or maybe about, I don't know, making Narcan more accessible to general people? Because as far as I know, I can't get it. I can't be able to purchase Narcan or use Narcan unless I go through training, and right. that's not going to help me with my friend who's overdosing right. in the bathroom.
Well, I hung up my dancing shoes a little while ago when I finished the rave culture book, so I'm not out there in the music scene anymore. But I do know that there are some types. While I might not have heard about what you're talking about specifically, I do know that there are some kinds of opioids people take. It takes more than one dose of Narcan to revive people. Sometimes it takes two doses. I don't know if I've ever heard of a third dose.
Sometimes, I mean, so the good news is Delaware has passed laws that you can go into a pharmacy. You watch it's like genuinely 3 to 5 minutes. You watch a 3 to 5 minute training video, and they will give you naloxone, and you can take it with you. There is also a lot of efforts, and I see Dave Humes giving me the finger back there in a good way. There are a lot of community groups, though, that are now also going out and distributing it for free. I do know, too, that, and maybe this is what Dave's going to say, there is going to be a training class coming up, too. But you can now go into most any police departments. You can reach out to community organizations. You can go to a pharmacy. And you can get it, and it does not take a long time. Because there are hugely more efforts now being made to get it out into the hands of the average person. Yeah, great question.
Just a couple comments on Narcan. You can go and get it over the counter at a pharmacy. You go to helpishere.de.com website. There's three different videos on there, depending on what kind of Narcan you want. And you watch those videos, you download a form saying that you understood the video and how to administer, you go to a pharmacy and you can purchase it. In addition, there's community trainings around the state that were had. And here on campus, there have been training to the student community. University of Delaware has purchased that Narcan for students. Hopefully, there'll be an upcoming training within the next month or so.
Wouldn't know about the videos or know about the
videos. Right. And that's a good point. There's a lot of work that needs to be done for public education. Education and prevention is something we also haven't talked a lot about tonight. And her questions and comments remind me we need to increase our efforts on education and prevention, not just for the general public, but for doctors and prescribers, etc. Yes.
You asked before about the technical literature, and sorry to be a geek, but with the pharmacogenetics and personalized medicine, about 10% of the people, Narcan does not do any good. And so part of it is we're having to come up for some patients a very different approach.
Right. Thank you.
Last question, maybe?
Sure. No pressure.
No pressure.
Sure.
So I'm actually in a lecture at the University of Delaware where we have been talking quite a lot about this. So there is the prescription drug monitoring program, because a big problem that we're noticing is doctor shopping. So you go to wherever you can be prescribed these. So if I'm not mistaken, I don't think the state of Delaware actually actively is using the program correctly. Do you think that that's something that's going to be happening soon, or do you think that it's just one of those things we're going to push out of the way?
No, I know that recent legislation, and I'm not going to get the particulars perfectly correct, so don't quote me, but they recently just passed legislation that lifts some of the barriers around it in attempts to make it more accessible and easier to use for doctors. Because there was a lot of pushback from some doctors that had said, we're having trouble using this, it's confusing, it's not necessarily doing what we need it to do. And so I know there is legislation that should be going into effect, if it has not been signed into effect already, or at least it might have been signed but not really fully in effect yet, that's going to make it easier to use for doctors.
Yep.
Because that was a huge issue for Delaware for a long time.